Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. U.S. Attorney General William Barr says the Department of Justice has found, quote, serious irregularities, end quote, at the Manhattan jail where financier Jeffrey Epstein apparently killed himself over the weekend. Media reports suggest Epstein was left unsupervised at the time of his death, despite a prior suicide attempt in July. Attorney General Barr also said today that Epstein's death won't stop the investigations into his alleged sex trafficking of young women.
Let me assure you that this case will continue on against anyone who was complicit with Epstein. Any co-conspirators should not rest easy. The victims deserve justice, and they will get it.
Here to discuss the investigation and where the criminal case against Epstein goes from here is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on.
So I'm hoping you can give us a little context here. I think for most of us, it was a pretty surprising story to see break this weekend. Were you surprised to see such a high-profile prisoner apparently able to kill himself in a federal jail facility?
It was incomprehensible. It was incomprehensible. I can't describe it any other way. We've seen an increase in suicides in local jails, where there is limited supervision, limited ability to deal with complex cases. We've seen an increase, sort of a spike in local prisons. The Metropolitan Correction Center, where this happened, is a, you know, high security, high profile federal institution that only, you know, months before had held El Chapo. So the notion that there is this kind of a breach and that's sort of the only way this could happen is extraordinary.
So a union official did tell the Washington Post that this jail is functioning with less than 70% of the needed correctional officers. What do you make of hearing that?
Well, that may well be so, but this is apparently, at least according to the reporting, there were two people assigned that were on call at this point. It's not like they only had one. The Washington Post reports that there were two people assigned, and they were not watching him. In addition, within the Metropolitan Correction Center, this was a special housing unit. So this was really for high-profile, more dangerous. I'm not sure what the standards would be, but it certainly was a higher security part of the prison. So even if the rest of the prison is understaffed, there's really no excuse for this to be understaffed. And there's no excuse for the people who were staffing it not to be paying attention.
So obviously this story broke over the weekend. We don't know a ton about the details yet. What are the biggest unanswered questions in your mind?
Well, I think that the question is the most likely explanation, quite apart from all the, you know, resounding conspiracy concerns, is negligence, or negligence of sort of a substantial degree. You know, why was Epstein, what kind of symptoms did Epstein show? Was the previous injury a suicide attempt, as the newspapers reported? If that's so, people are put on a suicide watch, which literally means that an officer is staring at you for 24/7. He was supposed to have a roommate. The roommate had been transferred out on Friday. Purpose of having a roommate is to make sure, you know, it's in part a security issue, depending on who the roommate is. But he was supposed to have a roommate. The roommate was out. He was supposed to be, should he have been on suicide watch? Even if he wasn't on suicide watch, he was supposed to be checked every 30 minutes, according to the newspapers. So there are lots of failures here. And they're stunning in the light of the accusations against Epstein.
Yeah, and so far a lack of details as to why there was no roommate after Friday. I think for a lot of folks, they saw this story. There was an immediate, at least folks in this area, an immediate connection with this and the Whitey Bulger incident. Is there a difference between the two cases?
Well, there's a difference. Whitey Bulger, and the other thing that comes to mind is the case of Hernandez. You know, Bulger was an assault in a prison. That happens. Too much for sure, but that happens. Suicide, particularly someone who showed suicidal ideation beforehand, is a different matter. We know how to deal with that. And suicide in a high security unit, in a high security institution, it seems to me is rare.
Yeah. In terms of the investigation into this incident, we heard from the Attorney General at the top. He has said that they will look into the details here. They found, quote, serious irregularities. That investigation is being headed up by the Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz.
That's right.
Attorney General Barr, critics would say he was partisan in the way he handled the Mueller report. How much faith do you have in the Inspector General's credibility here?
Well, I have a considerable amount of faith in the Inspector General's credibility here. I mean, the Inspector General is an independent branch, an independent agency, an independent entity, and who's supposed to sort of swoop into the Department of Justice and make, draw their own conclusions. They were the ones who determined that Comey had made errors in the way that he handled the Hillary Clinton email investigation. They were the ones who determined that McCabe had wrongfully released information. I think that they play things straight, and Horowitz is a former U.S. attorney, but has really shown himself to be quite independent. If the DOJ were doing the investigation itself, it would be different. But this is really an independent agency whose job is to be a monitor, sort of an ombudsman.
All right, so let's set that aside and talk about the criminal case against Jeffrey Epstein. What happens to that case now?
Well, that case is gone. That case is over. You can't prosecute against someone who's dead.
Yeah.
It also means that it was widely reported that because Epstein was facing so much time that the government may want him to cooperate, so he becomes a source of information for others. That's obviously over. So the investigation proceeds as to any other co-conspirators in the trafficking, any of the people who enabled Epstein, sort of in the way that the lawsuits against Harvey Weinstein talk about the people who had enabled him. And so that's still available. If the principal enabler, allegedly, according to the papers, is this woman named Ghislaine, I can't pronounce her first name, Maxwell, and she's apparently in Europe. And if they cannot find her and can't get her here, then she can't be prosecuted. But now it would be an investigation against, a criminal investigation against the enablers, civil lawsuit against his estate by victims can continue no matter what, but criminal cases can't if the defendant is dead.
Right. And that's Ghislaine Maxwell that you referred to there.
Ghislaine, is that how I pronounce her name? Okay.
Yep.
Thanks.
I was struck by a statement from Jeffrey Berman. He's a U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York.
Right.
Put out a statement and made a point to stress that there was a conspiracy charge involved here. You alluded to the co-conspirators. How likely do you think it is that we see others charged in this case?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know what information they have. So they certainly have materials, pictures, invoices, whatever, from his residences. That doesn't disappear when the defendant disappears. So they have the fruits of the searches that might possibly implicate others. They have the testimony of the women. And so they have the ingredients of a conspiracy and the possibility of going against other co-conspirators. The problem is they have to get jurisdiction over the co-conspirators. But I think that's the route.
All right.
Here.
So you mentioned that civil lawsuits are still possible. We don't really know much about the finances of Jeffrey Epstein. It's kind of even a question of how much he was worth. What does the law say about that? Whatever money his estate has in terms of who has first dibs? Is it the victims? Is it the prosecution? What happens next?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the victims, if the victims sue, then they can go after his estate and they win, then they can go after his estate and make claims against his estate. The government might have claims against his estate for taxes, for money that was somehow misappropriated. The government, If he were tried, the government could get restitution and fines from him directly. But without him there, the government has to go. It's mostly a theory of, did he wrongly come by this money that he should have paid taxes on, that he should have reported? They can still deal with his estate in that way, but that's a more difficult road.
So,
but the victims surely can sue and say, I'm damaged to X degree, and sue his estate for that amount.
So I'm curious, obviously there's more to come in terms of this story through the legal process, but with all of these developments, looking back at that 2008 plea deal in Florida for Jeffrey Epstein, how are you reflecting on that?
Well, I have to. That is even more incomprehensible. And, you know, I've been in this business a very long time. So the notion that U.S. Attorney Acosta was daunted by the lawyers on the other side, Ken Starr, Alan Dershowitz, these are daunting lawyers. But the U.S. Attorney's Office is used to dealing with, you know, major lawyers, particularly in Florida, where there's a very robust criminal defense bar. That doesn't make sense, that he could have been daunted to this degree, that he would have handed over the jailhouse keys to this group. One other theory was that maybe there were... you know, sometimes one is concerned, not with every U.S. attorney, but some is concerned that an assistant may want to trade in the hopes of a job after they, you know, stay on the good graces of these defense lawyers so that one day when they become a defense lawyer, they'll work in a big firm. That also doesn't make sense here because Acosta, after he finished his U.S. attorney position, wound up in a small law school in Florida, not a particularly high prestigious job. The other is that Acosta was saying that some of the victims were, you know, not willing to come forward, not willing to go through with the proceeding. My understanding based on the reporting is that there were 30 victims. So it's not he said, she said, it's he said, she said, she said, she said, she said. Right. 30 victims, I can't imagine the entire 30 would collapse. And then the other thing that Acosta said, which also made no sense, is that things were different in 2007. I was on the bench in 2007. Child pornography, people threw the book at, had among the highest punishments. Child abuse, child trafficking, these were taken very, very seriously. That doesn't explain it. So I'm mystified.
A lot of unanswered questions. Obviously, we'll continue to cover this story as it moves along. Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorek.